You are Locked On Hawks, your daily Atlanta Hawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 350 of the Locked On Hawks podcast. I am your host, Brad Rowland, coming to you live on this fine Tuesday evening. We've managed to make it 350 episodes. That's pretty crazy, honestly, to think about. And I appreciate everybody that's listening to the podcast for the first time, or if they listen to every single episode, I appreciate you all, and thank you for listening to the podcast today. So we'll kick things off, a little bit of a news and notes episode, a couple of audio clips from our good friends at the Dunked On podcast, Nate Duncan and Daniel LaRue. But before we get to those guys, the Hawks made a transaction on Tuesday. At least they reported one, as they have not formally announced this just yet as I'm recording this. But Adrian Wojnarowski reports that the Hawks are going to sign Jalen Morris to a 10-day contract. In the very near future, the Hawks have to sign someone to replace Arsene Lesova on the roster. This was already the case with Antonius Cleveland before, who is famously injured. But the Hawks have to replace Lesova as well in order to have 14 guys. And they'll honestly have to sign two players unless they sign Cleveland to a second 10-day contract. But in terms of Morris, a former Division II player, someone that I'm not overly familiar with. I would be candid about that. He's been playing in Erie this season for the Bayhawks, so obviously knows the system a little bit. That's probably one of the appeals to signing a guy like that who might be able to come in an absolute pinch and contribute. Morris is a 22-year-old. He's 6'5". I'm not really sure that I see it based on the fact that, based on the little bit of time that I've seen him and, of course, the numbers. He's not really a shooter at all, 28% from three this season, but he has been efficient in other ways, I will say that. Clearly a pretty solid G League player despite limited pedigree, and, if nothing else, it wouldn't blow me away if he never set foot on the court for the Hawks, but he's healthy and can practice and kind of, be somebody that knows the system, and clearly the Hawks are not necessarily taking these 10 days into huge account in terms of looking and sort of aiming high with these guys. So that's not a shot at Jalen Morris at all. Just one of those things where I'm not expecting too much from him, but that Hawks have a new player to bank on in the near future. Second thing on the podcast before we get into some Nate and Danny audio is that I sort of teased this a couple of days ago, but the Jimmy Butler injury really does affect the Atlanta Hawks in a lot of ways. Butler is now going to be officially out for about 4 to 6 weeks after meniscus surgery. That of course is sort of a interesting timetable in a lot of ways. He chose the quicker return surgery path, so that's something that certainly should be noted. But at the same time, no assurances that he'll be returning this season. At the time of this podcast recording on Tuesday night, the Wolves were the number 3 seed in the Western Conference at 38-26. They're only 18 games left, and they probably have to go 6-12, something like that, maybe even worse than that, to fall all the way out of the playoffs. Of course, this is all because of the fact that the Hawks have Minnesota's 2018 first-round draft pick. In some ways, Hawks fans have probably been rooting against the Wolves for at least the recent past because of the fact that, early on it was basically just, all right, let's make the playoffs, Minnesota. And then, after a strong start to the season, it kind of became, all right, make the playoffs, but not quite as good as they have been just yet, because ideally the Hawks will want to pick somewhere in the teens with that Wolves pick. But With this is sort of the backdrop. I will say this: it is possible now, in my opinion, for Minnesota to fall out of the playoffs, even though they are the number 3 seed at the moment. They are only 4 games ahead of the team in number 9th place. I will say that that's a huge drop to make, and a lot of teams to drop below in only 18 games or so. With that said, the Wolves have not been great this year without Jimmy Butler, so that's something that has to be said. I think in the grand scheme, this probably helps the Hawks. Of course, you don't want to root for injury, and obviously, Butler's a tremendous player and somebody that I really enjoy watching play. But at the same time, it's probably going to help the Hawks in terms of their positioning. I would probably project somewhere in the neighborhood of the pick landing in the 22-ish range, somewhere in the low 20s, whereas before the injury, I would have said probably in the mid-20s. So maybe 3 or 4 spots here that this helps the Hawks. And could be more than that. Could be, maybe Minnesota, catches the magic with Karl Anthony Towns and sort of hangs around the same area, and the Hawks are still picking 24-25. It's a lot of talk about what it could be in the near future, but at the same time, this definitely does impact the Hawks a little bit. And of course, in addition to the tanking race, the Hawks fans have very close eyes on Minnesota. That Houston pick that the Hawks have coming is already, basically assured to be either 29 or 30, as the Rockets and Warriors are dueling for the best record in the league. So that one I'm not really worried about much, but with some momentum to potentially move up in the draft, if you're the Hawks, you want to be rooting against the Wolves for the most part in the near future. With that said, we can get into some audio. I mentioned before, Nate and Danny are gracious enough to let us use the audio on Locked On Podcast Network. I really appreciate those guys. I recommend listening to the entire episode, but recently those guys broke down what they call a 15 and 60. Basically, they break down every single team in the Eastern Conference in a little portion of their podcast. They touched on Torian Prince and as one portion, and they touched on Ersan Ilyasova's buyout and the mechanics there as a second portion. So we're going to start with Torian on this podcast. I'm going to play the audio for you, then I will react to it. So it's a little bit longer than a normal clip, so bear with me there, but these guys are definitely, you know, keyed into the team and Torian, so take a listen to what they had to say about Torian Prince right now.
Where I wanted to go with this was catching up on Torian Prince. Talented player, and I think a big part of what you and I were so intrigued by this year with him was really what he would be. And that was a couple of different things. That was offensively, what kind of role was he going to have? It was clear it was going to be off ball, but, you know, was he going to be a shooter? Was he going to be kind of a slasher? And then where would they put him defensively? Would he be a three? Would he be a four? And I think we have a clearer answer, at least to me, on the second one of those questions. Defensively, he's played 86% of his minutes at small forward. When you look at the kind of his strengths as a player, I think they fit a little bit better to me there. He moves his feet better maybe than I thought he would coming out of Baylor, and maybe he can be a four in certain circumstances, but it certainly seems like the Hawks see him as a three, and it's the most scarce position in the league, so I understand why.
Yeah, you would like to see more minutes with him at the four at some point, perhaps with the departure of Ersan Ilyasova, which we'll get to. We'll see more of that because they really lack now any kind of a shooting option at the four unless they are going to have him play up. But as you mentioned, he's really the only traditionally three-sized guy on the roster at this point. It is the scarcest position, so you have to imagine that he likely will end up there. My thought on him this year, 3 and D at that position is excellent. You know, you're going to talk a little bit more about where his defense is, but I think I'm losing hope on him becoming more than just a spot up shooter and defender type of guy. I think he's a little bit too limited in terms of both his juice off the bounce and in particular explosion at the rim, and that also puts a little bit of a ceiling on his defense as well. Now, having strength, decent feet, decent length and size, like, that's all important, but he's not really a guy who is a huge steal or block guy. You know, he's not someone who really makes offensive players uncomfortable. I think he's more going to be solid. And granted, for that 2016 draft, which was not a great one, for the fact that you need just a starting caliber player on the wing, that certainly can be useful. But he's not, you know, you don't never see him with like spectacular dunks, and you don't see him finishing acrobatically at the rim. He's not really a fantastic passer either. You know, his pick and roll game leaves a fair amount to be desired at this point. He doesn't get to the foul line. And so I think we're looking at him as a guy who is going to be maybe an adequate enough offensive player to make some shots when he's fully formed. This is his age 23 season. A guy who maybe can attack a closeout, but not incredibly effectively, and hopefully can make open shots. I don't foresee that much upside for him on either end, but even having someone who is just solid enough to play the three is a valuable resource in today's league.
The most surprising element of his season to me has been the shift away from, I'll phrase it in this way, I'll phrase it in the more positive, the shift to three-point shooting. And so that is in terms of both attempt rate and also success. So his three-point attempt rate, that's the proportion of his shots that are from three, has gone up from 36% to 45%. That's a lot, and there are downsides to that, which I'm going to talk about in a second. But he's also making more of them. He's at 37% right now, and when you look at the distribution of his possessions, other than transition, and even that is pretty small relatively, he's been a spot-up guy. And really, he's been successful overall, a little bit under a point per possession there, and those are, other than transition for some guys, the most efficient shots that you have. So it's impressive that he's been able to do that. When I watch him, I don't see a guy who's just like, oh yeah, he's going to be a 37% three-point shooter the rest of his career, but they've leaned to that more, and if teams are going to start respecting it, that has benefits throughout the offense, because then that creates space for everybody else.
One of the things that you seized on here that I'd like to elaborate elaborated on is his work as a pick and roll ball handler. Actually, 130 possessions this year finished with a shot of turnover out of pick and roll. Really has not evolved a ton there. He is one of the worst players in the league, 0.55 points per possession on 130 possessions. And I haven't looked at the numbers, but I'd imagine out of guys who have run that many pick and rolls, and we're talking about three a game or so at this point, which is not that many, but still, you know, that's a decent number, that he's got to be among the worst in terms of his efficiency. And a big part of the reason for that is that he really, unless he's getting all the way to the basket, does not have the game to create much of a decent shot. Jumpers off the dribble out of pick and roll, 0.69 points per possession. Floaters, he's made 1 out of 9. And then if he gets all the way to the rim, only 1 point per possession there, so that's not really amazing either. And then he's also not really some unbelievable passer out of pick and roll either, and he's really going to struggle to be efficient because he's not a guy who's comfortable shooting off the dribble. He's not really that quick or crafty with the dribble to like get guys on his back and force the defense to react, and then he's not incredibly explosive at the rim. And so even to have him doing this much pick and roll handling, it is too much for him at this stage. And sure, this is Hawks University. Let him spread his wings a little bit. But I think he'll be much better when he's got other guys to set him up. And I do think with the lack of guys to set him up on this team, the fact that he's been able to shoot it decently from three is at least a positive indicator. Although, again, just with the number of attempts, hard to say where he'll eventually fall in his career as a three-point shooter.
So just a few things to hit on there in terms of their reactions to Prince at this point in the season. I wish they would have talked about his defense more, and that was something they probably, you know, they teased there and they kind of never got back to, which is unfortunate. But offensively, a couple of things. You know, the Hawks definitely see him as a small forward. I would echo that sentiment. I've always kind of wanted the Hawks to play him a little bit more at the power forward spot. At the same time, the Hawks roster does not necessarily dictate that as an option because Prince is really the only guy with small forward size. Andrew White is the only other player that's, you know, has that like legitimate, you know, 6'7", 6'8", kind of size to be playing. And you don't want to necessarily rely on him a whole lot. So I understand why Bud has not done that a whole lot. He's been doing a little bit more lately, you know, sort of with the tank in full form. But I do think that ideally you could see Prince as a small ball four option. He's just not shown a whole lot of that so far. I think the prism of him being a 3-and-D player is nice to consider, but it's definitely interesting to note how bad he's been as a creator offensively. Some of those numbers are pretty damning for him. His spot-up shooting has been good this season. That's something I've been quick to praise, is that, you know, that Taurean being a 37% three-point shooter is a very good thing. He can be a real player at that shooting level, and something that I was sort of questioning before the season is whether he would ever get to that sort of mid to high 30s three-point shooting. If he can definitely sustain that, that would be very, very helpful for him long term. It is definitely important, as they note, to have a player of his size at the three spot in today's NBA. You just have to have that kind of you know, ability, at least physically, to hold up against bigger guys defensively. I will say, and just expectation wise, the 2016 draft where they picked him, you know, number, you know, the stigma of being a lottery pick is kind of important, but this, it was kind of a bad draft in a lot of ways in 2016, at least that portion of it that where he was. And if the Hawks can just get a starting level player out of that pick, it would be a big time success. The jury is of course still out on that. Again, I wish they got into the defense. I think the biggest disappointment for me this season has been the defense by a wide margin. Offensively, you know, the numbers for him as creator are damning, but in the same breath, I think on a good team, you wouldn't see Taurean handling the ball as much as he has on this particular roster, because, you know, the Hawks give him free form, and they probably should from a development standpoint. There is every reason to go ahead and be happy with the way that they're giving him a chance to succeed and develop, but it's not gone particularly well offensively. I'm not really worried about offensively, though. There are times where he is frustrating on that end of the floor, but for me, it's all about the defense. If he can be an average defender, that'd be huge. Right now, he's certainly not that. At least, you know, part of its effort. We talked about that ad nauseum on the podcast in recent days, but just, you know, sort of getting that out there offensively, you know, hearing all that scouting report and the deep numbers is definitely important to take into account. But for me, at the end of the day, it comes down to the defense. Prince is never going to be dynamic enough offensively to be an offense-only player, an offense-first player. He's got to be a two-way guy, and defensively, it's been a really disappointing season for him. I do think that some tanking opponents, people that don't like the tank and rebuilding, I hear about those people all the time. I sort of understand why. I do think that that's sort of overblown in terms of the way that his effort is. He's the only guy on the roster this season, aside from maybe Dennis Schroeder. And with Schroeder, he had the same concerns last year on a playoff-bound team, so I'm not sure that's a new problem. But Prince is really the only guy that I think has real effort concerns on this year's team, so I'm not sure that's a taking system. A lot of guys who are on this team, they're veterans and young guys alike, play hard on a nightly basis. Torrey is not one of those guys. I think he's the only one, again, that's having that problem, so I'm not sure that's a taking problem. It's just more of an effort problem individually, and at some point he has to take responsibility for that and sort of be judged by it. So we'll see in the future. I'm not writing off Torian Prince by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, defensively, it's a lot of it could be could be the fact that Dennis Schroeder is not great either. Those two guys playing together have a 110.5 defensive rating when they play together this season. That's pretty bad. And of course, by the way, Torian Prince is 420th out of 488 people in the ESPN's defensive RPM metric. He's 77th among small forwards. So, and behind guys like Michael Beasley, Chandler Parsons, CJ Miles, Tim Hardaway Jr., guys, you're not thinking about being defense first player. That kind of illustrates just how bad Prince has been defensively this season. It's not just my eye test, and the numbers are not agreeing with him either as a defensive prospect. So, you know, the problem is for me, at least probably a little bit of the worry is that you hear a lot of people that still believe in Torian think, you know, he's a second year guy, but at the same time, he'll be 24 years old in March. This is not a super duper young player anymore. And you know, part of his appeal was that he'd be good right away, or at least solid right away. And we saw that in the playoffs last year when he was sort of giving more effort defensively. And sort of the jury's out as to whether he could turn that on in the future. With that said, one more thing to get to on the pod, and that is the Ersan Ilyasova buyout, which of course we talked about a couple of times, is now official. But I think it's always interesting to hear from guys who are outside of the Hawks bubble on issues like this that are, you know, transactional of nature and sort of the salary cap implications, all that fun stuff. So here's what Nate and Danny had to say about Ersan's buyout, the contract itself, and just sort of the way that all played out.
The last thing I wanted to talk about with them is the now buyout of Ersan Ilyasova. We'll see how much money that actually ends up saving them. Maybe that he ends up getting part of that room exception from the Sixers and they actually end up saving some millions of dollars here. But you'll recall that they had full bird rights on Ilyasova, signed him to a one-year deal for about $6 million, but then were unable to trade him because he had veto rights he would have lost his bird rights if he went elsewhere. And there even were discussions that could be traded to the Sixers. And then, of course, he now wants the buyout and he's going to the Sixers. And it really ultimately made little sense to bring him back because he probably helped them win more games than would have been good. He took away from the development maybe of guys like John Collins, although you do want to have those guys in competition to some degree, you know, so they're not just being gifted minutes. You're going to have some accountability, which perhaps he provided. But usually you'd say, all right, if you're going to just spend money on these guys, you might as well, you know, the idea is, okay, he sticks around for half the year, helps your young guys develop a little bit, and then you're able to at least get something for him in trade. But because of the fact that he had the veto, they didn't get that. So they spent, I mean, they don't have, it's not like they're, you know, they needed him in there to reach the salary floor. Their team salary right now is basically right at the cap. We'll see how much he ends up giving back. So they could have saved ownership money. They could have left some room to take on a bad contract from maybe a taxi. Maybe they could have taken on like a Jason Smith or something from Washington. They could have had that deal available. I know he has money for next year. Maybe they could have gotten into the Noah Vonleh sweepstakes or something like that. But and even then, if that wouldn't have worked out, I think the process would have been better there to just leave the space open rather than signing him because he did have those veto rights on the trade. So I think that ended up not really going that well for them for that reason. If you want to say if it weren't for those veto rights, then maybe it would have made more sense to sign to that contract. But he won them games, he didn't get them any assets, and then he also cost them space that they could have gotten assets for to take on some other money.
I'm a little less critical of it than you are, partially because
I'm not like that critical of it. I mean, I wasn't, and it's not like at the time we're like, oh, this is a terrible signing, you know, I mean, like this, but I think it's just, it's instructive that I think it's fair to say it didn't work out. I don't know that I was that critical of the decision at the time, but it does seem like if they'd gotten more of a Sixers-esque approach, you know, that's like Sam Hinkie would have never signed a guy to that contract, right?
And I'm sure it helped him. I mean, Sam Hinkie also wouldn't have signed Amir Johnson to his contract, and there are parallels there, except at least they could have traded Amir Johnson,
And Johnson has actually helped them, and that's sure. A team that's actually trying to
win. Yeah, that's
to
a good distinction to make. And also worth remembering with the Hawks, you'd say, oh, well, you know, they have the worst record in the league. They're 18-42. Actually, technically, the Suns are at 18-43, so they're one game off. But remember something that we've talked about before, that the teams at the bottom should be lower. And it's not fair to give the Hawks credit because the Kings and Suns have won more close games than they quote-unquote should have. Like, they would be a couple games behind them, probably, and that's significant in this race. So it worked out reasonably in that way, and also worth remembering, they were trying to get assets for Bellinelli as well. They got nothing for him. He's went to the same team. And I've floated the idea before, it's even more striking now, that this could end up being kind of like a slow motion trade where they end up taking Jared Bayless, this summer to take on his money. But instead, this way, the Sixers will pay Ilyasova and Bellinelli less. It'll be less on their books. And, you know, they could go moving forward. It would have been nice, I guess, to have, oh no, they would have lost bird rights on Ilyasova anyway. So it could still be the slow motion trade, but the Hawks aren't really getting anything for it except for what they could get for taking on Bayless.
Yeah. And I mean, hey, you know what? We'll see how much he gives back in the buyout, but they just kind of spent $6 million of ownership's money to make the draft pick worse, right? I mean, that's as a new GM, it would be nice to be able to go to your owner and be like, hey, you know what? Like, this is $6 million that we saved you this year because, again, they're well above the salary floor, even had they not brought him in.
So there's obviously a lot to take in there. I think the decision to sign him in the first place was a perilous one in some ways, which we discussed at the time. You know, the Hawks, I've said this a lot this season, but the Hawks did not lean into the tank as much as they could have, much as a lot of people would have argued they should have. I think, you know, Nate and Danny are definitely leaning into that that sort of thing. If you're not competing, that you should be trying to rebuild and get a higher draft pick. I'm of that mind as well, probably not as far as they are, but, you know, the tanking proponents will hate this conversation, but at the same time, like, they could have gone full Sixers, and they didn't do that. They signed Ilyasova, they signed Dwayne Dedman, they re-signed Mike Muscala, they brought guys back that would be competitive and tried to, you know, avoid, you know, winning 10 games. This team could have easily been much worse than it has been, and they invested in guys like Ilyasova as a result of that. I do think Ersan is a rotation big in the NBA for basically any team in the league. There are very few teams where he wouldn't play. And I think just in general, there's something to having a guy like Ilyasova on the roster as a veteran, the role player, and that sort of a mentor for the young guys, and that, you know, he knows what to do. He's always in the right place at the right time. That kind of player is appealing in some ways. So I think there's definitely some intrinsic value in that, even if it's not necessarily something that's easily quantified. You know, with that said, I don't think it's a terrible signing, anything like that. And I think they said the same thing, but it didn't go perfectly. I think ideally you would have gotten something for these guys at the deadline, you know, not trading Dedman, not trading Ilyasova, not getting anything for Bellinelli. All these guys, they obviously traded Luke Babbitt, but didn't really get anything for him. They made all these signings, and I assumed at the time, and I think a lot of people assumed at the time, probably the Hawks did too, that they'd be able to flip some of these guys. And with Ilyasova, they had to know. I mean, they knew when they signed him that they, you know, there was going to be some possibility that he would reject the trade. He did, and he did just that. So there was some risk in that way. So I think the quote that was sort of the money one from Nate, it was that the Hawks, and I quote, spent $6 million to make their draft pick worse, end quote. That's probably the dollars and cents of it. It's probably more black and white than I probably would be, but it's also probably true in the pure sense of things, and that Ilyasova helped the team win probably a few games that they wouldn't have won. And as a result of that, you know, they could impact the draft pick, even though that was, you know, I think that, again, it's not quite as easy as that. I think Ilyasova did bring some value to the locker room culture and all that fun stuff. But in terms of just, you know, plain what you can see, that's kind of an accurate statement. I do think that the Hawks, as I said, are better than some of the teams that they have similar records than. You know, Phoenix, Sacramento, other teams like that have been really fortunate. And as a result of that, the Hawks have been pretty lucky to be as low as they are in the draft. That goes back to what I was saying before about the Hawks not tanking quite as hard as they could have. They could certainly have assured themselves a higher pick than they probably will get if they continue to play hard. You know, obviously they're not playing well right now, and that's something that has to be said because, you know, with the rotation the way it is, they certainly could finish with the worst record or one of the worst records in the league. I wouldn't predict that, but that's certainly a possible outcome. still, they've been lucky to this point to be in that spot in terms of just a pure tanking race, and we'll see how that works in the future. But I thought it was good to provide some big picture sort of national NBA take on Ilyasova and just the way that he played and the way that it all played out. Because, you know, with Bellinelli, it was a little bit more clear. They already had him on the roster. They had done the trade for Dwight Howard, et cetera, et cetera. But with Ilyasova, they had to make the conscious decision to sign him, knowing that they couldn't trade him unless he approved it, et cetera. So a lot of dynamics in play, and it's always good to hear a different voice other than mine on some of these things. So with that said, that'll wrap up the podcast for today. A little bit longer than normal on an individual show, and that kind of, but you know, it's sort of bridged with the fact that you hear some different voices there. And I really appreciate the work of Nate and Danny. Please subscribe to that podcast if you are an NBA nerd, and I assume that you probably are if you listen to this podcast, at least about the Hawks. And those guys do a fantastic job. It's one of my favorite podcasts, and they, you know, deep dives. They do game stuff. They do transactional stuff. Some fun ideas and all that fun stuff. So check out Nate and Danny's podcast. NateDuncanNBA.com is the website. You can find all Nate's stuff, as well as the fact that it's a Dunked On NBA podcast on Apple Podcasts, all that fun stuff. So subscribe to my show as well. Obviously, if you're listening to this to the bitter end, you probably already do that. But Locked On Hawks, but you know, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, all those fun places, as well as PeachtreeHoops.com for every single episode. I really appreciate it. We'll be back again with a recap episode of the Wednesday game as the Hawks take on the Indiana Pacers. And the interesting spot, you know, rematch from last Friday's game in which the Hawks got worked up in Indiana. So we'll see how that looks, and we'll talk to you guys on Thursday.